The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Donald Trump's name is mentioned only once in the text of this book, but he sort of looms over every page of it. And one of the things that really becomes clear, I think, is that Richard Nixon put the interests of the country first eventually, that he realized he was probably going to lose in the end, but that it was better and sort of more important for him to step down and not drag this out for several additional years.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 9th, 2022. You may think you know all that you need to about the Watergate scandal, its origins, its evolution, and its implications, but there's been a lot of new information in the last couple of decades that is simply not in earlier full histories of the scandal. Journalist and popular historian Garrett Graff has written a new history of Watergate called, appropriately, Watergate: A New History. And in this book, he does just that. He brings in the information that has come together to write the first overall picture of Watergate in quite some time. I sat down with Garrett to talk about the contours of the Watergate scandal, but in particular about some of its national security and foreign policy episodes that are of high interest to our listeners. We discussed, among other things, the evolution of Nixon's thinking involving those tapes that he recorded of his White House conversations, as well as the extraordinary order that the Secretary of Defense gave during the height of the scandal to warn soldiers about following the Commander-in-Chief's orders. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 9th, Watergate Revisited, with Garrett Graff. Garrett, you started writing this new history of Watergate a few years ago now. What drove you to decide that we needed a new assessment of the Watergate scandal?
There were two things that drove me towards this book. The first is, as you know, David, because you know you and I have had parallel interests and lives over the last couple of years, I've spent the last 5 years covering Trump, Mueller, Russia investigation, and sort of all of the, you know, impeachments and crimes and corruption and criminality of the Trump years. And that all seemed really fresh, and I wasn't quite ready to write about that. And instead, I thought it would be worth going back and trying to look at the last time that we faced a president that was such a nexus of crime and corruption, and sort of how that process worked, you know, almost 50 years ago now, you know, how Washington was actually able to force Richard Nixon to resign in a moment where the, you know, all of the various levers of Washington, the media, the Justice Department, the FBI, the executive branch, the House, the Senate, the District Court, the Appeals Court, the Supreme Court, all came together to force Richard Nixon's exit. And then as I got a little deeper into the research, I realized that actually, you know, Watergate is a story that has been sliced and diced a thousand ways over 50 years in, you know, dozens, scores, maybe even hundreds of books. But it had actually been a quarter century since anyone sat down to write a full soup to nuts, start to finish narrative history of Watergate. The last two were Stanley Cutler's Wars of Watergate in 1992 and Fred Emery's Watergate in 1994. Mm-hmm. And that in the 25 years since then, we've actually learned a tremendous amount about Watergate, about the Nixon administration, and that those facts and those details actually really change the story that we thought we knew.
And that is what I want to dig into here, because most of us know the basic contours of Watergate, but I'm interested as we go on in you highlighting some of the things that new sources have made available, and the interpretation may be different than the mid to late 70s when people perhaps watched All the President's Men or read the newspaper accounts. So let's start with the actual break-in, or I should say the break-ins at the Democratic National Committee offices on May 28th and June 17th, if I recall correctly, 1972. Why was the team assembled by Howard Hunt and James McCord breaking in there? What are the actual theories about what they were doing?
For 50 years, we have shorthanded that break-in as a bugging operation, that they were trying to come in to bug DNC Chair Larry O'Brien's office. And one of the things that really surprised me is that it's not actually entirely clear that that was the case at all. And in fact, the reasoning for the burglary itself is really quite still hotly debated and contested. And there's a lot of reason to believe that, in fact, there might have been multiple motives that night among the burglars as they came in. And as you mentioned, I mean, part of what most people don't understand about the burglary itself is that it was actually the second burglary of the Watergate, that the burglars had been in several weeks earlier, attempted to install some listening devices, and bungled it. And so at least some of the burglars were coming in that second time with the hope of fixing the problems of the first burglary. Now, beyond that, there was a lot of open questions about what information they might have been searching for as well. Some hints about that they were searching for Democratic malfeasance and campaign finance violations. Some hints that they were searching for how much the Democrats knew about Nixon's own campaign malfeasance, including the illegal contributions he took from the Greek military junta in 1968, sort of money funneled from the Greek intelligence agency into Nixon's presidential campaign in 1968. Some questions about whether there was some Castro money involved in some of this. And then lots of open questions and suspicious circumstances about whether the CIA actually knew of the burglary as it was unfolding and attempted to sabotage it. Evidence for this includes the fact that two of the burglary team, E. Howard Hunt and James McCord, were retired CIA officers, and that actually one of the Cuban burglars was an active CIA asset and was on the CIA payroll that night, being paid about $100 a month, and had been steadily reporting his activities to his CIA handler. And a lot of suspicious movements and circumstances that night have led people to believe that the CIA had prior knowledge of what was taking place that night, and that they might have been responsible for actually helping to sabotage it and make sure that the burglars ended up getting arrested.
Which, of course, also led some of the president's men to settle on that as a potential way of shutting down investigation, of just stating that it was a national security matter and the Department of Justice and FBI should leave it alone.
Exactly. And that this becomes the involvement of the CIA, or the possible involvement of the CIA, really becomes a key part of what is later referred to as the smoking pistol in the Nixon tapes, and sort of Nixon's pressure to the CIA to get the FBI to shut down its investigation and stonewall the investigation under national security auspices.
But of course, the president and those around him knew that was crap. That was an excuse that they were using as a way to shut it down. It wasn't that they, in fact, were trying to protect some other major national security issue that, for some reason, and yet unexplained to me, somehow connected the Democratic National Committee to a larger national security effort.
Exactly. And that part of what becomes so strange about this is that what we now understand is that, you know, most people looking back, you know, if you understand the, you know, sort of gauzy Technicolor, Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman, all the president's men version of Watergate, think that the Watergate burglary was the beginning. But it was really like walking into the second or third act of a play without really fully understanding what was taking place before. Because, and this was a big part of the history that I tried to write and rewrite in the book, is that this actually traces back straight to the 1968 election. And that in the fall of 1968, there was this an event called the Chenault Affair, which has really only become publicly known and publicly understood in the last decade. Another part of that history that is sort of new to the telling of Watergate. And in the fall of 1968, Richard Nixon, campaigning for president against Hubert Humphrey, the vice president, actually interfered with the Paris peace talks and encouraged South Vietnam to stall the peace talks for his own political gain. Effectively, Richard Nixon asked the South Vietnamese to keep the Vietnam War going in order to help his electoral chances that fall. It is one of the only credible allegations of treason against a high-ranking U.S. government official in American history. And it was something that Lyndon Johnson learned at the time and tried to confront Richard Nixon about, but then decided that publicizing that betrayal would undermine Richard Nixon's moral authority as the incoming president. And so Lyndon Johnson kept quiet about it. The full details of it did not come out until about a decade ago, right, when a scholar named Ken Hughes wrote a book called Chasing Shadows about it and sort of fully traced it back with some newly declassified documents from the Johnson Presidential Library. But Richard Nixon knows that there's this deep, dark secret at the core of his 1968 campaign, and that basically it sort of becomes the telltale heart that infects the whole rest of his presidency. And you see his paranoia and criminalities sort of rise through the end of the 1960s and the early 1970s as he tries ever more desperately to cover up this Chenault affair, and that this is really becomes the reason that he goes so wild about the Pentagon Papers in the spring of 1971. The leaks there lead him to create the Plumbers Unit that brings G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, and other men into the White House, people who had no business being close to the presidency. And then, you know, it's Liddy and Hunt and McCord who end up going off the deep end in 1972 with the presidential re-election campaign.
Right.
And that in many ways, sort of the Chenault affair becomes the original sin that undoes the rest of the Nixon presidency.
Yeah, there's really two things here that are interesting in this early part of it. And one is that backstory, which is that Watergate was not an isolated incident. In fact, it was perhaps the break-in and the bugging or whatever it was one of the least disturbing things that was happening with the Plumbers Unit and related dirty tricks matters. But the other side of it, especially after the break-in and as months go on, there is the intense reporting effort. And especially in late 1972 and 1973, the reporting really starts ramping up, including the team of Woodward and Bernstein at the Washington Post. I'm guessing that in the public consciousness of Watergate, for people who are not immersed in politics or national security, that three things still stand out when the word Watergate comes up. One is probably the fact that there was a break-in and cover-up. I think that's probably generally understood at some level. The second is that Nixon ultimately resigned, connected to that somehow. The third one, and I think there is only another one, is that Watergate is somehow connected to the heroic efforts of this team of Woodward and Bernstein. But over the years, we've learned about, among other things, some ethically disturbing choices they made regarding things like members of the grand jury and outing a source. Talk through that a bit. Why is there this myth of heroic journalism so intrinsically tied to the public feelings about Watergate, and how has that endured despite this information coming out?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and it was one that, to me, was one of the most surprising aspects of my research and writing for this book, was to understand how blown out of proportion Woodward and Bernstein's role in Watergate actually was. That Woodward and Bernstein definitely mattered, but not in the way that we thought that they did. That sort of the popular history that we tell of Watergate is, you know, the break-in, yada, 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 Woodward, Bernstein, John Dean, Irvin committee hearings, and then, you know, Nixon resigns. And it has a certain level of, you know, inevitability to it in the way that we try to tell the story. And in fact, that's not what it looked like at all as the scandal unfurled and unfolded through 1972 and early 1973, that the actual cover-up almost succeeded, that there are solid half dozen times between July 1972 and March 1973 where it looks like the cover-up has succeeded, that Nixon has sort of shut down the last thread of the investigation, that he sort of kept this thing buttoned up and away from his own White House. And it's not really until March in April of 73 that you begin to see it break wide open and turn into the sort of cascading series of political earthquakes that ultimately end with Nixon's resignation in August 1974. And that what you actually end up seeing is that over the course of that fall, Woodward and Bernstein are hard at work tracking this story for the Washington Post, you know, both relatively junior reporters, as the mythology goes, and is was actually the case. But that there were a half dozen reporters that we actually owe shared credit to for breaking key stories at key moments in that fall that actually kept the story going. Actually, Woodward and Bernstein had both been taken off the story and had been sort of deposited back in their day-to-day lives at the end of July 1972 before the New York Times' reporter Walter Ruggiber broke the first public story about how the burglars had been financed with Nixon campaign cash. Then it was a Los Angeles Times duo, Jack Nelson and Ron Ostro, who in October 1972 managed to get the first interview with one of the burglary participants, a man named Al Baldwin, the former FBI agent who was sort of the lookout on the night of the burglary, and that it was his first person story published in the Los Angeles Times that connected the burglars and the Nixon campaign and the Nixon White House really for the first time. And it, and sort of made the story personal and big and scandalous in a way that it really hadn't been before. And then it was actually another New York Times reporter, Seymour Hersh. He, another one of these legends in journalism who most famous then for breaking news of the My Lai massacre. He was the one who broke in January 1973 the story that the burglars were being paid hush money to keep silent about their role, their family, you know, help preserve their families if they stayed silent and took the prison deal that was being offered. And it was really those three stories, as much as anything that Woodward and Bernstein did, that tipped the Watergate story over from sort of odd political trivia into catastrophic political nightmare.
Sure. And I think, you know, in the public consciousness, certainly the reporting was big for moving the story forward, but Watergate would not have evolved from the clumsy break-in and the arrest to Nixon's ultimate resignation through the public hearings and the activity going on in the courts. It certainly would not have gone forward in the same way without the famous tapes. These are the conversations in the White House and elsewhere that Richard Nixon was covertly capturing. And the one of the conversation on, I think it was June 23rd, between Nixon and Haldeman in the White House, which provided that so-called smoking pistol that Richard Nixon was indeed knee-deep in the cover-up. There was no airtight evidence of Nixon's complicity in the cover-up, nothing certainly as crystal clear about his obstruction of justice without those tapes. Now, Nixon had listened to the tapes as 1973 went on. He knew what was on most, if not all of them. So the key question, what do you think? Why didn't Nixon just order the tapes destroyed before turning them over?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think to me, it's one of the strangest unknown mysteries still remaining. Nixon had started his presidency by tearing out all of the recording devices that Lyndon Johnson had scattered over the across the White House. He did not want any of his words recorded. Then, as his presidency unfurled, he became concerned that he wasn't going to get credit for his own brilliance, that sort of most specifically Henry Kissinger was going to be out there taking credit for all of the things that went right and laying at Nixon's feet all of the things that went wrong. And that it was really only a couple of years into his presidency that Nixon made this secret decision to install these recording devices in the Oval Office, on his telephones, in his old executive office building, hideaway office, and even in the residence and at Camp David. And that these devices end up capturing all manner of suspicious and worrisome conversations. And I think one thing that's sort of worth pausing here to talk about, David, is the maxim that Washington learns from Watergate is the cover-up is always worse than the crime.
Right.
You know, that's the, you know, one of the great lines to come out of Watergate. It's, you know, something that you hear in every crisis and every scandal in Washington. But when you go back and you actually look at it, it's not actually true in Watergate, because what it turns out is that the crimes themselves were actually quite bad. Mm-hmm. They were very numerous. There were a lot of different crimes, abuses of civil liberties, you know, the Chenault affair, you know, illegal campaign finance contributions from foreign governments, from U.S. business leaders, from companies.
There was no shortage of crimes being committed.
Right. And one of the weirder things that I sort of learned in the course of this writing and research is that actually probably Nixon's crimes were worse than his cover-up. But where this story really breaks open with the tapes is in the summer of 1973, Alexander Butterfield, White House aide, testifies in front of the Irvin Senate Watergate Committee and says for the first time that there are recording devices and that all of the conversations that are in dispute between Nixon and John Dean and other aides, that there's actually recordings of them. And this ignites this firestorm between Nixon and Congress and the Watergate special prosecutor, first Archibald Cox and later Leon Jaworski, as they end up battling all the way to the Supreme Court about whether there is an executive privilege that should protect these tapes. You know, again, many people, although, you know, I would imagine Lawfare has spent dozens and dozens of hours over the last 5 years talking about executive privilege. You know, most people don't actually realize that executive privilege started with Richard Nixon, and that it was the battle over these tapes that went all the way to the Supreme Court that for the first time established the existence of an actual executive privilege for the president.
Let's talk just a bit about the public hearings. How important were the open congressional sessions for public opinion and the evolution of the crisis and the escalation of political options as the Watergate crisis continued?
Yeah. One of the arguments that I make in the book is that Watergate really creates modern Washington, and that one of the things that really stands out to me in this is that there was actually not much of a history of congressional oversight of the executive branch before Watergate. I mean, sort of what we now think of as de rigueur for congressional committees investigating the presidency and executive branch really began in many ways with the Irvin Committee in that summer of 1973. And that when the Irvin Committee staff went back to sort of look at how to do this, they didn't have many analogs to draw from. In fact, one of the examples that they ended up pointing to and drawing from was the congressional investigation of the Battle of Bull Run in 1861, you know, just to sort of show you how far back they had to go to find similar types of activity. Mm-hmm. And so the Irvin Committee holds these big, splashy public hearings, and they become must-see TV for the first time in the United States in a way that the country has never experienced before. And their TV networks, you know, again, this was a time when there was just the three TV networks and the beginnings of public broadcasting. And they carry the networks and PBS carry the Watergate hearings live most days. They air something like 200 hours of hearings live over the course of that summer. And amazingly, the average American household watches almost 40 hours of the hearings over the course of that summer.
That's amazing. I mean, it really shows a couple of things. Obviously, one is now we have the era of Netflix and YouTube and no shortage of other distractions as opposed to simply the major networks and perhaps public television. I'm not sure how much public television had permeated American households by then, but there were just fewer options. But the second one is just how dramatic this was. The Kennedy assassination really opened up the Americans' television experience with the presidency in a shocking way. But it was really Watergate that solidified it in terms of watching something as it unfolded.
Yes. And this becomes, you know, and again, these are sort of things that are that we are used to in modern life, is the way that sort of ordinary witnesses and lawyers in some of these congressional hearings become stars in their own right in Washington. But for Washington at the time, this was brand new. And the idea of these Nixon aides, of their lawyers, of the committee staff becoming these, you know, famous figures in America was new then. You know, Sam Irvin, there are Sam Irvin fan clubs that pop up all across the country. And, you know, the lawyers and investigators on the committee, you know, become used to being recognized in restaurants, and you know that they sort of become public figures in a way that was really unique at the time, mm-hmm. and something that, of course, sort of since then we have gotten very used to.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you. Constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare 20.
It's almost like the crossing of politics and entertainment, which certainly wasn't new in American history, but you can easily see how the public hearings set the stage for things like the Iran-Contra hearings, where Fawn Hall became almost as much of a public figure as Oliver North himself because of her appearance in the hearings. Let's address some specific national security aspects of this time and Watergate's effect on national security. The big one certainly is the October War in 1973. Walk through how the president's distractions, at a minimum, and perhaps his temporary inability to function, affected how people like Henry Kissinger managed that crisis.
Yeah, this is, again, part of what is so fascinating about understanding the full scope of Watergate is realizing how there are, Watergate really is the story of a dozen interrelated but distinct scandals over the course of the Nixon presidency. Watergate really is sort of more of a mindset than it is a single event. And yet sort of as you begin to unpack those, you find these stories that if they had occurred under any other presidency would be among the most dramatic moments in modern American history, and yet are sort of shorthanded as like just part of Watergate. And the sort of best example of that is, as you say, October 1973, when you have three stories combined into what is surely one of the wildest months in all of American political history. You have Vice President Spiro Agnew facing down this historic bribery investigation that ends up forcing him from office in early October. He pleads guilty to bribery in a Baltimore courtroom after months of back and forth with the Justice Department, pleads guilty moments after resigning the vice presidency, and it's the first time a vice president has ever been forced from office, and you know would normally be one of the most corrupt things that we've ever seen take place in and around the White House in 250 years of American history, and yet you know, is sort of a buried storyline of the larger Watergate story. Month continues with this dramatic showdown between the president and Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox as they battle in court for access to some of these tapes that we were talking about a few minutes ago, and it ends up leading to Nixon ordering the firing of Archibald Cox. The Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, refuses and resigns. Mm-hmm. Nixon orders the Deputy Attorney General to then fire Archibald Cox. The Deputy Attorney General, William Ruckelshaus, also refuses and resigns. And it ultimately falls to Robert Bork, the third ranking official in the Justice Department, the Solicitor General, to end up becoming acting attorney general and then firing Archibald Cox.
And fascinating, I would note that Robert Bork doing so can be seen on its face as less courageous than what the attorney general and the deputy attorney general did. But there was a reason for it in that there was no clear method of succession for ruling or managing the Justice Department if there was not an attorney general, a deputy, or a solicitor general. And the feeling among the three of them was that somebody had to mind the store, and perhaps things would be worse off if there were no one in any of those positions and Bork had stepped down. So it was not perhaps merely or at all a spineless decision to say, I am going to assume the role of acting attorney general. And in fact, I think you noted that Bork himself, when offered the job of attorney general, said, no, I am only doing this temporarily because of the circumstances.
Exactly. As you said, the line of succession at the Justice Department didn't go past him. And so there was no sense of who would take over the Justice Department if Bork actually also resigned. And of course, Bork ordering the firing of Archibald Cox becomes a key part in his Supreme Court nomination in the 1980s, opposition by Ted Kennedy, that sort of, in many ways, I think sort of poisons the Supreme Court nomination process in a way that we are still struggling literally right up to today with, you know, Joe Biden's latest Supreme Court nominee. And so, you know, you have these two huge apocryphal stories playing out in the background, the Saturday Night Massacre, resignations of the Justice Department leadership, the resignation of Spiro Agnew, an empty vice presidency amid all of this. And then we get to where your question began, which is the Yom Kippur War unfolds through October 1973 as well. And Israel is hit by this surprise attack from its Arab neighbors, faces a devastating set of military setbacks. Very quickly, you know, Israel gets down to a few hours of ammunition and supplies left before the U.S. launches a massive resupply mission, one of the largest military materiel missions in world history, bigger than the Berlin airlift.
It takes them a while to get there, but once they do, It is truly a massive effort that shows the American commitment to Israel.
And then, as Israel begins to turn the tide, there becomes this panic on the Arab side, and they turn to the Soviet Union for help. I'm sort of shorthanding a lot of very complex geopolitical machinations here. And in a way, again, that we sort of forget decades later, the U.S. and the Soviet Union come to a very tense moment in the Cold War, in the midst of this Yom Kippur War, that leads to one of the only times in American history that we have raised the DEFCON level, the defense readiness level, and seen the Soviet Union follow suit. And through all of this, Richard Nixon, who is weathering the resignation of his vice president, the battle for the tapes, Saturday Night Massacre, is drinking heavily and despondent and depressed and isolated in the White House residence, and effectively leaves his chief of staff, Alexander Haig, and Henry Kissinger, his Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, to handle this crisis without him. And it's this incredible moment in national security history where we see the DEFCON level raised, and there is no evidence that Richard Nixon participated in this in that conversation at all. That basically it was Nixon's staff preparing the U.S. to go to war without any input from the president.
To the point, if I remember correctly, that during the height of the crisis and the president was down in Florida, they take steps in the president's name back in Washington without even bothering to wake him up, in part because they wonder if Nixon is capable of thinking clearly at the time.
Yeah, and there are these incredible exchanges where, you know, for instance, the UK prime minister, I think it is trying to reach Nixon to speak with him. And Kissinger says, "Don't put the call through. The president's too drunk to talk right now."
Remarkable. Absolutely. The other national security aspect I wanted to talk to you about is something that you and I talked about several years ago now, is we were both trying to chase down the provenance of the story and any evidence we could find for it actually happening, that in 1974, as the crisis continued to escalate, that the Secretary of Defense, Jim Schlesinger, had put orders down the chain through the military saying, if you receive any orders from the commander in chief to execute involving nuclear weapons in particular, do not execute without checking with me first. And that's something that, as I recall, we both had trouble feeling confident about, and we were very careful about our language, you in your article and in my book about how presidents leave office. We both struggled with how to wrap the language around the uncertainty element, the lack of confidence of what happened and how. You found some new information on that. What do you now think happened with that incident? And how much more confident are you that there's something to that story?
Yeah, so you're exactly right, David. This is in the years after Watergate and Nixon's resignation. James Schlesinger, the Secretary of Defense at the time, talked publicly about the idea that he had effectively tried to circumscribe Nixon's nuclear powers mm-hmm. in his final days, that there was a lot of fear about Nixon's mindset, that there was a lot of fear about Nixon's sort of irrationality in those final days, and that he, Schlesinger said, you know, effectively, no one had anything to worry about. You know, we had put out orders that there weren't supposed to be any, you know, nuclear launch orders communicated without double checking with us first, which, as you know, is highly extra legal and contrary to DOD Nuclear National Command Authority, because the president is supposed to be able to launch nuclear weapons at any time with no secondary check or secondary voice necessary in that system. And in fact, that's an important part of the speed of the entire national command authority, is that, you know, once the president issues that command, it is considered lawful and people can set about executing it. Now, we'd had this sort of idea that Schlesinger was out there saying this, but we had never really seen proof of that order translated out into the field, and that there'd been some conversation among some other White House, senior Defense Department officials about that order, but it had never really been traced out into the field. And I actually, in my research, as you know, David, this has been an area of interest of mine for years. And one of my previous books, Raven Rock, was all about, you know, the nation's nuclear command system and doomsday planning and continuity of government and so forth. And I actually was able to locate a soldier who was stationed in a nuclear armed unit in West Germany at that time in August 1974, who remembers the order and was able to sort of talk me through what it looked like in the field for the first time. And the order is effectively what James Schlesinger said it was, which was, you know, if you receive any orders to launch nuclear weapons, please check with the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State first before executing those orders. And the soldier that I spoke with, you know, talked about how that had been received in his unit, how they debated it among the commanders of the unit, you know, whether it was a lawful order, you know, given the circumstances around Nixon's final hours as president. And then there was sort of this, he said to me, you know, I thought about saving the order, you know, and preserving it because so unprecedented and so wild. Mm-hmm. And he was like, but, you know, I knew what trouble I would be in if anyone ever discovered that I had saved.
Yeah, that's not something one does.
Basically, a nuclear launch order,
right,
for posterity.
It also makes me wonder, because we don't have dozens or hundreds of others telling the same story, how many units that did not get passed down to, that commanders in between saw it, recognized that even under these unusual circumstances, that was not a lawful order, and decided not to pass it to their units. So others may not have seen it like that officer did.
Yeah. To me, this is sort of more proof that there was some set of orders that were transferred out into the field. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if it's far from clear to me what precisely they were and where they went.
Let's move to the end game here. Nixon, in retrospect, especially with the light shed on Watergate from the Trump administration, it sure looks like Nixon could have fought this out, could have forced those, particularly in the Senate, who were leaning towards convicting him should there be an impeachment, which was highly likely, and then a trial. He could have forced those in the Senate, to actually go through with the conviction instead of just putting pressure on him to resign, threatening that they would vote for conviction. Why, in your mind, did Nixon ultimately not fight this out and force it to go to an impeachment and a Senate trial?
It's an interesting question to me in terms of the parallel to Donald Trump, because I think one of the things that we see, and this book, as I've been saying, Donald Trump's name is mentioned only once in the text of this book, but he sort of looms over every page of it. And one of the things that really becomes clear, I think, is that Richard Nixon put the interests of the country first eventually, that he realized he was probably going to lose in the end, but that it was better and sort of more important for him to step down and not drag this out for several additional years as a fight. By the way, basically the same decision that Gerald Ford makes a couple of weeks after Nixon's resignation to pardon him is the idea that it was important for the country to move forward and that he, Gerald Ford, couldn't govern as president if the nation was going to be focused on various criminal trials of Richard Nixon in the years thereafter. And to me, it's one of the real big differences between what you saw take place in the Nixon years and what you saw take place in the Trump years was A, Nixon's misguided but true love for the country and sort of appreciation of the office of the presidency. And then also there's sort of this complication that I think is sort of worth talking about as well, which is how Congress acted as a co-equal branch of government in those final minutes and days and hours of Watergate. That one of the things that I think really stands out in the difference between then and now is the members of Nixon's own party were willing to stand up for Congress as a co-equal branch of government and to defend Congress's prerogatives and Congress's role in a way that we never saw, you know, the vast majority of Republicans be willing to do in Congress in the Trump years, which was they were Republicans first and members of Congress second. Mm-hmm. Whereas you see that dynamic very dramatically reversed in the Nixon years, where people like Howard Baker, people like Lowell Weicker, people like Barry Goldwater even, were very clearly members of Congress first and Republicans second.
It's funny how in reading through your retelling of the Watergate story, how clearly that comes through, that in 1973 even, how the prospect of Richard Nixon being impeached and removed from office were inconceivable. And yet by July, early August of 1974, it seemed inevitable. And how quickly that could shift with a few key people expressing that, yes, despite sharing the same R after our name, I can't continue to support this. And then the momentum that built.
Exactly. Yeah. That this sort of tidal wave unfolds very quickly once it starts, and that Republicans turn on the president in a way that was really meaningful.
To close, we've talked, Garrett, about the pedestal that the public has put Woodward and Bernstein on, and we've talked about the political culture that Watergate helped spawn, the Washington, the way that we know it now. But what other takeaways do you have stepping back on the whole arc of Watergate and its impact? When you have to describe the importance of Watergate overall and incorporating the new information that you brought forward, you know, what is it that stands out to you as what people really should take away here?
Well, so one of the things that's interesting, David, you know, we haven't actually even really talked about this, is one of the biggest things that has changed in our understanding of history around Watergate is the role of Mark Felt, the source, the Woodward and Bernstein source known as Deep Throat. When I sat down to write this book, it was the first time anyone had ever written a history of Watergate knowing the identity of Deep Throat. And that really dramatically, as a single fact, changes our understanding of what transpired in the midst of Watergate. Because what we have seen is that, you know, in the Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman, All the President's Men movie version, we see Hal Holbrook, the person who plays Deep Throat, as this, you know, shadowy and important good government figure out to, you know, preserve American government and decency in the face of Nixon's corruption. And as it turns out, that's not what Mark Felt was doing at all. Mark Felt was the deputy director of the FBI, was pissed off that Nixon had passed over him to be the director of the FBI in the wake of J. Edgar Hoover's death about 6 weeks before the Watergate burglary, and that Mark Felt wanted to sink the acting FBI director, Patrick Gray. And so Mark Felt's leaks weren't about sort of good government and democracy. They were about sort of bare-knuckled, bureaucratic, self-serving knife fighting. And I think to me is a really important example of how sort of the history that we think isn't necessarily the history as it's actually being lived, and that it's worth waiting to try to understand some of these events with a much larger sweep of history. And I was, it was really fascinating to me sort of how much just simply understanding Mark Felt's identity changes the story of Watergate as we know.
Garrett, thank you for walking through these elements with us. There's obviously much, much more. And I will say, as I'm looking here at the stack of books in my library of Watergate books past, that this is the new go-to single volume on Watergate, the new history that you've written. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, David. It's always a pleasure to be on Lawfare.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. We appreciate all that you do to publicize the Lawfare podcast and our other audio productions, like Rational Security, Chatter, and The Aftermath. You can also become a material supporter of Lawfare, helping us to produce things and everything else we do, and get some benefits by going to our Patreon account at www.patreon.com/lawfare. This episode was engineered by Hamza Chatou of Goat Rodeo and edited by Jen Pachihowell. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.